Welcome back to Datenspuren, or specifically to a talk in conjunction with the Libertäre Tage, the Libertarian Days. And this talk is titled The Modern Left and Anarchists in Israel. And you can see our speaker here on screen already. We have a Jitsi line open now. And they are going to give an introductory talk and then a Q&A afterwards in the usual fashion. And this talk is not being recorded, so specifically the person on screen is just acting as a relay, the person on stage. We will be going around collecting your questions, and we will be relaying them through the person on stage driving the Jitsi call. And so there will be a delay as your question gets repeated into the call, and then you can hear your answer. So don't be confused that it takes like half a minute maybe for the answer to start.
Right, thanks a lot. So one more time, thanks for coming. This is one of the last events of the Libertarian Days Datenspuren. Yeah, we are still collecting donations for covering the cost of people who were traveling here. So if you feel like, okay, I have too much money, or you have some money, you can drop it in the donation boxes. Yeah, and please do not run away when we are done with the whole event. We would love you to help us with cleaning up everything, because there is a lot of work to do, and you can contribute a little bit of your work for that. Right. So as we were mentioning, like, we start with Zahar, and then we, after the talk, do question and answer section. Right? Thanks a lot for joining us. This was like a messy organizing, but we managed to do it. Yeah, and I give word to you, and I'm just going to the audience. Thanks a lot.
Okay, so hello everyone. Thanks for having me. It's always strange to speak to an empty screen, but I'll do my best. Maybe you can mute yourself, because otherwise I hear myself as an echo. So I think that that would make it easier for now before the question begins. Thank you. So as was said, my name is Sahar. I'm an activist from Jerusalem, born and raised, and have been involved here in different radical left movements, including Anarchists Against the Wall, as well as other different activist groups here. And what I was asked to speak about today a bit is kind of the current reality or political reality in Israel from a kind of left perspective. And there's quite a few different things going on, and I'm going to try to touch on three main things that I think that are important for this conversation right now, as far as kind of updates as where Israeli politics is going. And I'll try to speak also a bit about the connection between those things. And I'm going to start by sharing, just see if I've managed to share my screen here. There you go. Perfect. So just start by really talking about the big protest movement that's happening right now within Israel. And this has to do with the judicial overhaul attempt. So we currently have an extreme right-wing government after quite a few rounds of elections in which the country in many ways was in a political deadlock for the last almost 5 years. And this government that we have currently is a highly is a very right-wing government that, among other things, one of its main projects is this judicial overhaul. And what this judicial overhaul is, it's a group of 142 laws, but that mainly what they tried to do is decrease the power of the judiciary in the country, and in that increase the power of government and the parliament, because we have a coalition structure for governments. In many ways, parliament and the government are one and the same. If there is a majority, then they can operate together, and therefore the judiciary is kind of the main balance for that. And they're trying to weaken it in different ways. Part of it is just allowing the parliament to overwrite decisions of the Supreme Court. Part of it is by appointing legal advisors for government, for parliament, for different ministries as political appointments as opposed to as professional appointments. Part of it is within the committee that selects judges to have more power for the government. So there's a lot of aspects to it, and I won't go into the technicalities of it, but it has created quite a backlash. And while right-wing governments, we've only had right-wing governments for over 20 years now, and in those 20 years, there have been a lot of extremely right-wing policies, but they have never had the reaction that these policies have. And if I try to explain a bit what's happening in this moment from my perspective, is that while Israel went through a lot of political instability within the last few years with elections time and time again this has started a bit before COVID, so there was a lot of instability, but in many ways the country's economy, institutions have remained very stable. And there is within Israel, I would say, an elite that there's also a very right-wing elite, and we'll talk about it later a bit, that has a lot of political power and economic power. But there's also a kind of centrist liberal elite with a lot of economic power and political power. And for years, they have concentrated their power mostly on the economic aspects and much more on politics. And when they were in many ways not represented or not winning within the political context, it didn't bother them as much. And in many ways, it's part of what kept at least the economy of the country stable throughout a lot of political turmoil. But what happened with this last government is that in many ways, this last government has decided to really challenge a lot of the core values of that group, of that pretty significant group within Israeli society. So maybe going even before the actual judicial overhaul and the laws that they were trying to pass, one of the first laws that this government tried to pass just after it was elected was a law that would allow people to discriminate against people who they don't want to give services to. So it's a very American kind of law. We know it from the US in the context of, you know, wedding planners that refuse to give services to LGBTQ couples or things like that. So they were trying to pass a very similar law here in Israel. And one of Israel's main banks, as a response to that, said, even if it will be legal to discriminate in that way, we won't give loans to businesses who choose to discriminate in that way. And in a way, that was the beginning of this clash, right? This clash of a liberal group with a lot of power in this country, including banks and a lot of the business sector. And we've seen that play out in the last few months, telling in many ways this government, you have gone too far. We do have some values that we will fight for. And in many ways, the hundreds of thousands of people that we see going out to the streets in Israel every single week for months now, and really unprecedented protests within the Israeli context. At this point, probably thousands of people who've been arrested. I don't know how many roads that have been blocked. I mean, it's an ongoing, long-lasting protest movement with a lot of people, a lot of power, a lot of money. I mean, a lot of the economy of Israel is also invested in this. It's a very big and substantial movement that woke up because this status quo between the right-wing government that in many ways historically was allowed to do almost everything it wanted to for Palestinians and other marginalized groups, but not to touch some core liberal values, has threatened those core liberal values, and the judicial overhaul is the symbol of that. But if you hear what people talk about, they talk about the fear of discrimination against women, against LGBTQ people, and kind of more the liberal framework of discrimination. It is a very important movement. And I think, I mean, I will obviously in this talk be also critical of it and critical of its roots. Because as I said, it is a very liberal movement. And if we're coming from the left, it's important for us to recognize that and recognize its downfalls. But also to say it is an extremely important movement, because it is true that we have a government now that is trying to pass all these laws and to have more power in a way that in many ways will further distance Israel from a democracy. I'm not going to say that it will make Israel not be a democracy anymore because, and we'll talk about that a bit later, I don't think that a country that also controls millions of people without the right to vote, talking about Palestinians, is a democracy. But within the borders of Israel itself, this is a significant difference that's happening and a very large political movement opposing that. And now when we come from the left, we need to ask, where is the left within this movement? And it's important to say, before I even speak about the left itself, what is very absent from this movement, and that is generally true for a lot of Israeli politics, is that 20% of the citizens of the state of Israel are Palestinians or Arabs. And in many ways, this protest movement doesn't invite them, doesn't try to get them in, or at least not in a way that they can really be part of it. And the political representation of the political group in this protest movement, the kind of the parties of the center, they're called center left, but I will call them the parties of the center, also don't try to work with these Arab parties, the political representation of these people. And so first of all, it's important to say this whole thing, this whole protest movement, and the entire discourse about the judicial overhaul is a very Jewish Israeli discourse. And I'll speak later a bit about where the Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel, where their energies and thoughts are currently. So it's important to say who's not in this protest movement. But if we do ask where the left is within this protest movement, it is very interesting to see that in every single one of the protests in the big cities, and now more and more in smaller locations, these protests have been happening every week for over 6 months now in dozens of cities around the country. In every one of those, there is also what is called the anti-occupation bloc. There is a left-wing representation that specifically speaks about the occupation and connects it to the judicial overhaul. And there's a lot to say about what is the connection between the judicial overhaul and the occupation at large. Obviously, this government, this very right-wing government, did not start the occupation. And a lot of the policies that they are enforcing are policies that have already been in place. But that said, this government is a government that its ideological line very much comes from what we call the settler movement. The settler movement is kind of the national religious part of Israeli society that is very right-wing, very ideologically married to the concept of having Israeli control from the river to the sea of the entire kind of biblical land. And in many ways, we'll say, and we see politicians from these parties say it very clearly, will say that they believe not only do Jews have a right for this land, but it is an exclusive right. It is a right that can come at the expense of anyone else and has roots of supremacy, very much rooted in it as a movement. And it happens to be that the people leading the judicial overhaul come from that movement. They come from that ideological movement. And if you see the examples that they give for why the Supreme Court needs to be reined in, for why legal advisors for the government need to be reined in, and that the parliament needs to control them, most of the examples that they give to the public have to do with the occupation. They are mainly saying, we want to be able to occupy more freely. And that currently there are too many restrictions on that. And the fact that they are making that connection is very interesting for this protest movement, because I think that part of our role as a left within it is also making that connection, right? Is saying what we are seeing now in Israel is a result of allowing this political ideology, this very right-wing nationalist ideology to do whatever it wants, and it has been doing whatever it wants for a very long time within the occupied territories towards Palestinians. And that power trip that they have is part of what allows them now to push things like this judicial overhaul. And so the connection in many ways is very much there. It's there in the people, it's there in the ideology, and it's there again in the examples and the rhetoric of the right wing itself. That said, the protest movement, the mainstream anti-judicial reform protest movement, doesn't want to be seen as left. We can talk about that later in the questions if people want to, but the kind of traditional political left in Israel doesn't exist and hasn't existed for a very long time, the one that's actually represented in parliament and things of the sort. And what that means is that this mainstream protest doesn't want to touch that issue. And it feels that if it'll touch the issue of the occupation or kind of issues that are clearly left, it will lose. I would argue that a lot of the reason that they think that way is that they are only looking to the right as far as changing Israel's political organizing, right? If they're saying we are at a political deadlock in a way that there's almost 50% here and 50% there when it comes to voting patterns to the right and to the center, or between these two camps, the right and the center. So they're saying our strategy is to steal votes, right, from the right. And in order to do so, we need to be speaking a language that this right is willing to listen to. This does two interesting things. First of all, is that it makes them just ignore a lot of things that they should be talking about because they're too left. But it also means that they are, again, they're not looking to what is to the left of them when they speak about potential political partners, right? Theoretically, the Palestinian Arab Israeli parties in Israeli politics could also be that turning point, right? With more Palestinians within Israel voting for Israeli parliament and with Israeli mainstream politicians willing to build coalitions with Palestinian parties, which currently, unfortunately, doesn't happen, there is already a majority. That is one way that that center camp could change, this deadlock could change the balance. But they don't do that. They don't look to the left. They very, very clearly look to the right to try to convince it. So that's one downfall. The other downfall, and I think Israel is a very good example of this kind of politics, is that the Israeli right has understood a very long time ago something very clear about kind of how to move politics in this country. And that is that the Israeli right constantly pulls to the extreme. Okay, it pulls, I mean, the most radical settlers, extremely violent, outspokenly supremacists that 20 years ago were seen as extreme, crazy people, including some who have been convicted of terrorism, today are ministers in the government. And they didn't do it by changing their politics at all. They continued to speak the exact same rhetoric, but slowly started having other people even more to their right or doing even more extreme actions and shifting the entire discourse to the right to a level where they seem like a specific kind of right that's not even the most crazy ones, and the people slightly less to the right from them who are still in any international discourse would be seen as completely right are now seen as almost moderate in that context because they keep pulling the discourse to the right. While the center camp also tries to speak to the right and also in that pulls the discourse to the right instead of actually having a clear left ideology that pulls in the other direction. And I think that that's one of the downfalls of Israeli politics generally. But here in this protest, what it means is that these massive protests of hundreds and thousands of people who have also labeled themselves very strategically with the Israeli flag. The Israeli flag has become the symbol of this protest, which has a lot of advantages, but for instance, it excludes almost by definition Arabs who will not identify with this flag. It leaves this protest not really being able to speak to a lot of the core issues that allowed this situation to happen, and within that, the occupation. And as I was saying, there are people in every protest bringing up the occupation. And I am happy to say, just so it doesn't sound too depressing, that these groups, this anti-occupation bloc, is growing. Today, I think there's over 20 different anti-occupation blocs in protests around the country that are constantly growing. And some of their messaging is managing to get into the mainstream protests as well. And probably the strongest example of that was a few months ago. There was a pogrom. A group of Israeli settlers went into a Palestinian village called Hawara in the West Bank and just burned the place down, beat people up, broke windows, burned cars, burned houses. It was, I mean, a crazy day. And even within Israeli media, it was very much covered. It was a big issue. And in the protests that were happening at the time, people brought it in there. And when they were standing in front of soldiers and police officers in the mainstream protests, they started chanting, "Where were you in Hawara?" which is also what the sign of this man here on the right says, with a burning village in the background. And it was, in a way, a moment in which you saw the mainstream protests starting to bring in issues of occupation, starting to bring in issues of settler violence into their discourse, and positioning themselves against that, right? Positioning themselves in the camp that there's the camp that is a liberal camp that is against these pogroms and this violence and the settler violence. And there is the other camp that is trying to push the judicial overhaul and is supporting the settler movement. So that's one interesting political thing that's happening that I don't want to paint a pink picture. The mainstream protest is still very much struggling with how to talk about occupation and not to, and it's a challenge. But also this is slowly shifting. This discourse is slowly coming into the more mainstream conversation in a way that it hasn't for many, many years. But there's another aspect of Israeli politics that's happening right now that is getting less coverage than the judicial overhaul, and definitely less protests and less resistance. And that is that, again, this very right-wing government is pushing a lot of different right-wing policies, including occupation-related ones. And the main one in that is annexation, de facto annexation of Area C. I don't know how many, I apologize for these technical terms, and I don't know how many people know this, but the West Bank is divided into three areas. They're called A, B, and C. Very broadly speaking, Area C is 60% of the West Bank. It's most of the open areas in the West Bank. It's where the vast majority of Israeli settlements are. And it's an area that the Palestinian population of it is relatively more rural. It's a lot of agricultural communities. So it's much more rural. It's much more dispersed. There isn't the same kind of density. And it's also an area that is under complete Israeli control. Both military and administrative. It means that every building permit, every connection to water, everything that happens, every road, everything that happens in that area of the West Bank that under international law is obviously occupied, is completely under Israeli legal system, under Israeli military law. And that area is extremely important because when we talk about, when Israeli politicians talk about annexation, they're mainly talking about annexing that area. They don't want to annex the big cities of the West Bank, Jenin and Ramallah, where there are hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in each city. They want to annex the areas, the lands, in which that are not densely populated, where they can take over land. And that's always been the policy. And annexation is obviously illegal under international law, and the international community keeps saying you can't annex and you can't annex. And so what we're seeing is a de facto annexation. And one of the main changes of this government is that we now have a settler who lives in a settlement, who is very much from this ideological camp that is really from the far right, who is now responsible within the Ministry of Defense for all civil issues in this area, C area, meaning he is responsible for who gets permits and who doesn't, which means obviously Palestinians will never get building permits and settlements always will. That has already been the case. The military has already acted in that way, but now there's a political appointment that is making that even worse. And it means that when the settler movement is sitting in the Ministry of Defense, when they are sitting within the government and pushing their policy, then also the settlers on the ground understand that as a green light to do whatever they want. And the reality that we are seeing currently is that just in the past few months, since this government has been elected, we've seen 7 Palestinian communities, mostly shepherding communities, that have left their communities, that have left their homes because of settler violence, often accompanied by military. And the picture that you see here on the right is from a village called Insamia. Insamia was a Palestinian village in the Jordan Valley that was the residents of it left about 2 months ago, 3 months ago now. And you can see kind of what was left behind. And the reason that they left is guys like the guy that we see here on the left. It's mostly young settler youth that are receiving lands from the state to open up farms, mostly sheep and goat farms, and start with using these farms to take over Palestinian lands. And where Palestinians usually shepherd, to kick them out, often very violently. We've had numerous attacks with the idea that Palestinians will then lose their livelihood, as well as threaten them in their homes, and that then these Palestinians will leave. And so this seems a million light years from the protest movement in Tel Aviv, but these youth, these settler, right-wing settlers, are the same ones who burnt down Hawara, and that then the protesters in Tel Aviv were starting to wake up to them. And also they're just the ones who are actually enforcing the policy, the general policy of this right-wing settler government, that for them, the judicial overhaul is in many ways a way to allow this reality and to legalize it, right? So it was important for me to kind of make those connections, because those are two major shifts that are happening right now in Israel. And the international community or media is hardly talking about the connection between these two things. They're hardly talking about this part of it at all. And it's extremely important because as far as the strategy of this government is concerned, these things are completely connected. And the politicians on the right will say that very, very clearly. And what this means is that we now, in a matter of a few months, having 7 communities leave is an unprecedented level of displacement in over 20 years. And that's something that in many ways is irreversible. And I think that it is important for us as a left to say, okay, we have a huge protest movement that's happening. On the other hand, we have this thing that's happening on the ground quietly that is completely changing realities. And how do we as activists bring one into the other? And it's two directional. On the one hand, it's trying to bring the issues and the political awareness into the mainstream protests about what's happening in the West Bank. But on the other hand, it's trying to bring the people from the mainstream protests to the West Bank. Because in many ways, the only thing preventing now, or not the only thing, one of the things that helps prevent now Palestinian displacement is on the ground, grassroots activists doing accompaniment work. And a lot of where the kind of more radical Israeli left is today, as far as what we can actually do in terms of a direct action that has meaning, is being in these villages in the West Bank to protect them, to give them a feeling that they're not alone within this, and doing this kind of protective presence work. And I'll just give you an example. One of the communities that is under threat of leaving, it's hardly a 10-minute drive from Ensamia, from this place on the right that where people have left. And they had a lot of attacks of settlers, not only on their herds, but in their houses, breaking windows, beating up old people in their houses. And in the last few weeks, they've had protective presence 24/7 of Israeli and Palestinian activists that are constantly there. And settlers continue to come. Just today, settlers have made 3 visits to this village already. But because there are activists there, because there are a million cameras there, those visits end differently, right? They are still threatening. They're still not fun, but they don't end with a community being terrified and wanting to leave. And that's something that requires presence. And presence that, again, if I think about what we are doing as a radical left today, is also bringing people from the mainstream protests in Tel Aviv around the judicial reform to the ground in places like this to start to understand what the occupation is, what does it actually look like, what are the connections to the judicial overhaul, but also how to resist it, and that there are things that can be done on the ground for that resistance. So those are kind of the first 2 out of the 3 things that I wanted to speak about. And the third one will seem a bit different, and its direction is a bit different. But I think, again, I was asked to talk about the political moment that Israel is within right now. And so we have that political moment that's happening for Jewish Israelis that is very much centered around the judicial reform. We have the political moment that's happening in the West Bank that is very much centered around annexation. And we have a political moment that's happening, or reality that's happening for Palestinian citizens of Israel, that really in the international community, I hardly hear any coverage of or any discussion about. But if you speak to any Arab Israeli, any Arab Palestinian citizen of the state of Israel, if you will speak to them today and ask them what is the biggest issue happening politically, they will all give you the same answer. And that is the crimes and killings within that community, the Arab Israeli community. And I'll soon speak to what that means politically and why it's such a big political issue, but start just by saying what it is. Palestinian Arabs are 20% of the citizens of Israel that, legally speaking, should have the same rights as I do, right? They have the same passport, they have the same ID, and theoretically we should be equal. We all know that, like any other society, that's not how things work. Marginalized groups are marginalized in budgets, in incarceration, in a lot of different things, in education. And that is also true for Arab citizens of Israel. One of the things that's really spiked in recent years, and this has to do with the lack of education and infrastructure and budgeting and investment in this community, but not only, and I'll speak to what else, is that crime rates have gone extremely high in these communities. And today we're talking about over 171 people who've been killed since the beginning of the year of 2023. Just to clarify, that is more people than the Israeli military has killed in the West Bank and Gaza this year, right? So for Palestinians, the issue of crime is on a daily basis more dangerous than the Israeli occupation, which obviously is the main thing that we often talk about and kind of bring up. And there's a huge question of why this is and what the community is asking for, but the community is now coming out in protests. And mainly what they're criticizing is what we know to be true in many marginalized communities around the world, and I'm sure you can find the equivalents in Germany, is the idea of under-policing and over-policing at the same time, right? Idea that groups like Palestinian Citizens of Israel, groups that are by the government, seen in many ways as an enemy that needs to be oppressed, suffer on the one hand from over-policing. If they protest anything, there will be police coming in and arrests. Teachers are afraid to say anything political because the Secret Service will arrest them for it. People get arrested for Facebook posts all the time. So there's this level of over-policing in things that, that the state sees as problematic for them. But you also have the under-policing, which is that issues that are seen as internal issues, things like crime, things that mainly just harm the community itself and in many ways devastates it, right? Keeps it weak. Those are areas where the police doesn't function at all. When we talk about Arab citizens of Israel, it is the population with the highest illegal arms in Israel, except for settlers. So the two groups that have illegal arms in Israel are Israeli settlers that mostly use these arms against Palestinians in the West Bank, and Arab Israeli citizens that mostly these arms are used against themselves. So in a way, you can see a policy of the Israeli police to not enforce or not try to find, confiscate, and prevent illegal arms in two populations that use these illegal arms against Palestinians, right? As long as you use it against them, the Israeli state doesn't care. But for the community, this is obviously the biggest issue. Now, again, this is kind of a different kind of political issue, but when we talk about what are issues today, like major things for people's lives within Israel, this is definitely one of them. And when we talk about us as a left, what we should be talking about, thinking about, responding to, I think it is extremely important to see this as one of them as well. And if we take this back to the judicial overhaul, this is again the voices that are missing from these pictures with, you know, from the center of Tel Aviv, of people going out to the streets, protesting, willing to give their time, willing to give their freedom when it comes to arrests, willing to really be there all the time, but not really seeing what are the issues of the rest of society around them, be it occupation on the one hand, be it the crime rates within Palestinian society, and trying to make those connections and trying to get this mainstream protest that is in many ways very privileged. And again, I completely support it and think it's extremely important, right? If this judicial overhaul passes, it will have really severe consequences. But there is a question here of trying to get a protest movement that is very privileged to also see the rest of what's happening around them. And that, I think, is one of the roles of an actual left, of a radical left, including obviously anarchist movements and activists in Israel within this wider political context. On that note, and again, as someone who's just looking at herself on a screen, I'd much rather open this up for questions and see what your thoughts are on this issue.
All right, who's got questions? I'm not seeing any hands go up right now. So you have the perfect opportunity right now. We have 45 more minutes for questions.
Can you explain a little bit these army reservists or the military reservists that are striking because of, like, what is the politics of this group?
Yes, great question. Thank you. So there has been within this kind of judicial overhaul protest from the very beginning, there were people whose main kind of identification within the protest movement was as reserve service soldiers. One of the strongest groups within this movement is called Brothers in Arms, which is mostly combat soldiers. Who've been organizing, reserve service combat soldiers who've been organizing in a lot of the protests. And more recently, after the first law within the judicial overhaul was passed, many of them said that they will, and this is an interesting and important phrasing, that they will refuse to volunteer into the reserve service. And this is an interesting phrasing, because there's two forms of reserved service. There's reserved service for people usually more or less until the age of 30. That's mandatory, and you can't refuse to, I mean, you can refuse, but it's not a volunteer basis. And currently, the mainstream letters of refusal that have come out do not include that form of refusal. They're actually from much more high-ranking officers, people who are slightly older, people from more elite units that continue to serve also later on in life, and that's on a volunteer basis. We've had that a lot with pilots. Pilots continue to serve many times until their 60s and 70s, and that includes a lot of reserved service and trainings, because for a pilot to, you know, actually go into an operation in Lebanon next time there is one, if they're a reserved service, they still have to fly every week to stay in shape, so to speak. And that's all volunteer-based. So actually what people said that they will refuse, for the most part, from the mainstream protest, is refuse that, refuse their volunteering. It's interesting because it is very much still playing within the legal framework, right? Nobody can force them this volunteering anyway. Nobody's going to go to prison for refusing this. But they're using their power, and in many ways also their symbolic power, because the Israeli military and serving in it has a lot of power within Israeli society. To make a point, and in many ways, the military has already responded to this rather scared, right? They are afraid of losing a fair amount of their reserve pilots, for instance. And losing them, again, not because they're legally obliged, but because a lot of the system actually is based on volunteering. And that volunteering can be lost relatively very easily. The reason that I make this differentiation is that at first, as I'm a refuser myself, I refuse military service. And at first, for us as refusers, we were like, this is amazing. Finally, people are legitimizing the concept of refusal on political grounds. And it was interesting to see how much this movement was like, well, I mean, not really. We're just like, they're not volunteer. Like, it was important for them to make that differentiation and not affiliate themselves with refusal. But it is also interesting to see that that was maybe important for pilots who are 40 and 50. But for younger people, we are seeing the beginning of that discourse also more in the mainstream. Just 2 weeks ago, there was a letter of 200 Israeli high school students who call themselves Youth Against Dictatorship, who signed a letter that's now growing of saying that they'll refuse to serve in the military. Because of if the judicial overhaul passes, as well as because of the occupation, they were already making this connection and also bringing it up to the level of actual refusal. And they were hosted and created an event in a school in Tel Aviv, which is completely unprecedented that a school will host a refusal event publicly that also speaks about the occupation. The principal of the school was fired. or forced to hand in his resignation because of this. But that is happening because of this more mainstream protest that people within it are saying, well, actually, let's radicalize it. And refusal is one of the forms of radicalizing it. And I think it's interesting to see that generally the fact that refusal is starting to become something that we can talk about as a political strategy and becoming a bit more legitimate. The fact that boycotts are becoming a bit more legitimate. There were at the beginning, you know, these banks that were saying that they won't give loans, like it was saying we're allowed to use economic power for political change. The fact that there are protests of Israelis outside of Israeli embassies around the world, and there's a lot of attempt of this movement to speak to the international community and have pressure come from there as well, is also an interesting shift within Israel of saying it's legitimate to ask the international community to intervene in our politics. Now, all three of those things are seen as completely illegitimate when they're done around the occupation, right? Refusal, boycotts, and criticism of, or kind of working and lobbying international community for change here is seen as something that is completely wrong if it's done around the occupation. And now, because it's being done around the judicial overhaul, those tactics are becoming a bit more legitimate. And I think that's really interesting and a really great point to bring around the refusal. So thank you.
Any additional questions? Yeah.
Could you also say something about reactions from Gaza and West Bank, reactions to the reforms, like from the authorities and from people?
I mean, so the authorities have not been very vocal about, I mean, the Palestinian Authority has said, you know, this looks bad and don't do it kind of thing, but I think they understand that their voices on this are not very not very significant. It is interesting to speak to Palestinians around this, Palestinians on the streets kind of in the West Bank and so on, that on the one hand understand that this is going to be a problem, right? They do understand that it's going to make things worse. But at the same time, for them, it seems almost like they're missing the point. And that's what they keep saying about it. It's like they keep protesting. And there's something emotionally even pretty hard about seeing hundreds of thousands of people going out to the street to protest about the Supreme Court when the same people never protested the biggest human rights violation that Israel has been doing for decades. Not only didn't protest it, but participated in it. And that's a lot of the reactions that I get from Palestinians, is this like duality of saying, obviously this is bad and we're glad that there's resistance to it, but also how come this is what brings people out to the street? It's almost, you know, like it's annoying almost to Palestinians. And I get that. And it's also seen as something that's happening in a different universe. And that's very strong, that most of the Palestinians I speak to about them, it's like, you know, they look at the TikTok videos, they're like, they know what's happening, but it's like an issue that's happening next to them and not really on them, because what does affect them is what they're seeing on the ground. And that's just kind of the same thing, just worse. So I think that that's the main reactions. I think one of the interesting things that did happen is that there was definitely an attempt from the Israeli military with a government decision, obviously a political decision, to escalate things, both in the West Bank and in Jenin, and also there was a moment the same with Gaza. And in both cases, it was pretty clear that Palestinian leadership was not interested in escalation. And while for Netanyahu, an escalation right now would be very nice politically, because usually any kind of, you know, war, conflict, anything more armed, everybody would align. The protests are likely to stop, if not completely, at least to decrease significantly, and everyone will kind of toe the line. So it's very much in his interest. But it seems like in the attempts that happened, it seemed like both the authorities in the West Bank and in Gaza did not allow that escalation and did not kind of feed in to that so far.
Yep, we have another question.
Yeah, hello, and thanks, by the way, for the talk, and thanks for like the point you've mentioned about like the colonial basis of the former uprising reforms that you have now in Israel. I mean, like that the first Israeli state were like exposed colonial violence to the West Bank and to the Gaza, and now they're exposing violence to its citizens. Like, I had, I guess, two questions. The first one, maybe if you can share the perspectives of the cooperation between like the Jewish Israeli left and the Palestinian left, maybe like you can see the perspectives about that. And the second one was about like the stories of your success, I mean, in recruiting people from this liberal protest to the field in the West Bank and in Gaza. Like, I remember you told this story about like the family or like some buildings that were kind of protected because of the people were there and the activists were there, like, and they were kind of safe. And like, maybe you can share another story, something like similar to that, or like the ways, how did you manage to recruit those people? How did you manage like to bring them? Like, what helped you, or what helped your community or your like initiative or like whatever?
So I'll start maybe with the second question and then get to the first one. So, I mean, it is important for me to say it's still very small scale. Like, you know, there's a process of hundreds and thousands, and we managed to bring dozens more in to work on the West Bank. So it's a very small number, but it is very significant for this kind of work. And it is a beginning of something. And as to how, so one of the things that happened around these kind of anti-occupation blocs around the country is that there was also a feeling that a lot of new people are joining a protest in a bloc, right? They join the anti-occupation bloc on the ground because they see it, they agree with the messaging, but how do we then keep them, right? And make them part of a movement. And very early on, there was a beginning of just opening a huge WhatsApp group, kind of just for circulation, not for conversations. It's an admin-only kind of group. And that now already has, I think, close to 4,000 people that were all just collected from these protests. So people started talking to people and just said, okay, you want to hear what you can do? You want to join something? Join this group. And that has allowed us now to have access to a lot of people that are politically there, generally go out to protest. Like, I mean, they will come out of their house at least. And that we can try to mobilize into other things. And a lot of different groups have done a lot of different things around it. There are a lot of tours. I was speaking to a friend who works in an Israeli left NGO, human rights organization, that has regular tours. And they always had, you know, every 2 weeks they had a tour. And usually they would have maybe 20 people in a tour, 15 people in a tour. And now they have 100, 150 people every tour, and they have to open new tours and more days. And so, like, people are interested. They are coming from this. And the next level of it, in bringing them to the field, so really even, you know, around this community that I was talking about earlier today. So 2 weeks ago, a group of activists said, okay, we need to coordinate the logistics for this better. We need more people to do these 24-hour shifts. And just literally opened a Google form, right, that says, if you want to volunteer, fill this out. Here's the details. Here's whatever. And we sent it out to these 4,000 people. And we've had dozens of people who have never been on the field before, who, you know, their only protest in their lives, who have been in Tel Aviv, who are now spending nights in Palestinian communities in this kind of protective presence work, literally from sending them a form, which feels like the most basic thing, but it's really like, it is very significant for our movement, this kind of widening that, again, it is small numbers. I don't want to, you know, create an image that it's a huge movement, but for what's happening on the ground, it's extremely significant. And it's numbers we don't like. In 2 weeks, having, I think, over 40 new people come and actually do the work is, I can't think of a time like this. You know, it's like in your terms, think about, like, you know, in a couple of weeks, finding dozens of new people that are willing to do direct actions of, you know, blocking what, like, it's that level of what you're asking people. And we are getting that. So that's amazing. And I think it has a lot to do with people feeling like they want to actually do something. Like, they see this reality and they're like, I have to do something actively. And the other aspect of it, and I'll connect it to this question about the cooperation, is that in many ways, Israeli society and Palestinian society are very segregated and have been for a very long time. And for people who are anti-occupation but have not been in the field, they also live in a segregated space. And I think for a lot of them, even just coming to, you know, spend a night in a Palestinian village, and you're there for protective presence, but you know, you speak to people, you're in, you know, in a community, you have interactions, is finally breaking a lot of that segregation and finding a space where you can share space with Palestinians, political space with Palestinians, and in some ways start to build a lot of what we kind of imagine as a future. And that's very powerful. So a lot of the cooperation that happens between the Israeli left and the Palestinian left is just on the ground, right? Like, coming into communities, we don't just show up one day. You know, you're invited into communities, you have build relationships, and obviously take Palestinian leadership with, like, whatever they think should happen, and the kind of way that we should behave and things like that is, like, you know, if settlers come in, we don't decide what to do. It's about what the community wants. So that cooperation is very strong on the ground. And it's not only with the communities themselves, it's also with other Palestinian activists that come from different places. There are, in a lot of these communities, there are young Palestinians who come from the bigger cities, also like left activists, also coming for this kind of protected presence. And so those relationships are just happening on the ground. On a political level, it is very different. I mean, if we think about a political left, there are Palestinian political left parties. One of the biggest ones is the PFLP, which is unfortunately designated as a terrorist organization by Israel. So, you know, a lot of the time, like, how do you even cooperate with the left on an official level? You can't, because there's all these kind of restrictions in place. And a lot of the political organized Palestinian left was just criminalized, which makes it very hard to cooperate with it on a political level. That said, of course, there are relationships between the Communist Party, the Palestinian Communist Parties in the West Bank and the Communist Party in Israel. These relationships do happen also on a political level, but I think today the most significant cooperation that I see is just what's happening on the ground, on the grassroots level.
Further questions?
Yeah, I would like to know about like workplace organizing and like unions in Israel, and like how political are they, and how big is their role and was their role in organizing the big strikes in March, and how many people are organized in unions or similarly.
We have the biggest union in the country, which kind of unionizes a lot of the different sectors, is a union that existed from before the state. It's kind of very much from the heart of the Zionist movement pre-state. And it's, you know, the biggest kind of social workers, teachers, nurses, doctors. I mean, the biggest unionized groups are unionized through this union. And because of that, because it's kind of very institutional, mostly pretty mainstream union, it is also very hesitant to do anything that might seem political. One of the kind of turning points of this protest movement was in a day where the Minister of Defense at the time, Gallant, resigned, saying that he won't vote for the judicial overhaul and resigned, or was fired, but kind of knowing that what would happen. And the following morning, I mean, that night was the biggest protest that we've had so far. This was already in March, end of March. And the following morning, this union, this huge union, announced a strike. And that ended the phase one of the judicial overhaul, and started a very long negotiation. And, you know, the government continued to push it, but very differently, in a very different pace, in a very different kind of way. Was very much symbolic to that moment of, like, even a union that isn't radical, that isn't going to take risks at this point, was part of that tipping point in that moment. But now that one of the main laws, reasonability law, passed a month ago, that union didn't strike again. So you do have that kind of more mainstream unionized power that, when it does move, has a huge amount of power, but really will only move and use that power in very extreme examples. You do have smaller unions, many of them much more political and so on, but they are also, most of them have not touched this issue. Only when there's, you know, huge protests, they'll join in. They definitely don't touch issues like the occupation. And in many ways, the union movement here is relatively very weak. And there's more and more laws that are trying to prevent the little power that it does have. The judicial overhaul will actually have a huge effect on unions. And this is why that big union did actually do something, because a lot of the time union disputes end up in the judiciary system. And so far, the judiciary system has been pretty lenient towards allowing strikes. But they're definitely talking about, I mean, they're actually talking about taking away the right to strike. So this is also an anti-union thing that's happening. But the union discourse in Israel, politically speaking, is not really where it should be. So unfortunately, I don't have a very inspiring answer to that. Again, the union does have a role, and if, again, very severe things will be pushed, when that union, just because of the size of it and the scope of it, when it does act, it is very hard for the government to ignore it.
Next question. Yep.
Hey, thanks for your talk. I have a question which is touching the question of refugees. Like there's a bigger community which, I mean, maybe anyway doesn't have citizen rights and maybe don't get, but I was wondering if this is a chance right now to organize together, or are these communities are anyhow involved in this protest, or yeah, are there any alliances?
So I'll start by saying that in Israel there is no path for citizenship for refugees. More than that, there is no path for refugee status. There is, but almost nobody gets it. So legally speaking, most of the refugees that live today in Israel are legally asylum seekers, and don't have refugee status. And that's because Israel just doesn't give it. So the entire political conversation about like what is the role of refugees in Israeli politics is very, very limited, because it's very clearly a population that will never have electoral power. Israel, generally, there is no path for citizenship in Israel, except for being born Jewish or marrying an Israeli citizen. That's literally the only two paths for citizenship in this country, which means everything that has, it's not just refugees, this also obviously affects migrants and of other kinds, and not just refugees. But that's a whole issue in and of itself. And that, what that means is that, again, these are not issues that are very much easily connected into this bigger protest, because they're not seen as an important population for this protest. The judicial overhaul will definitely affect refugees horribly. And this is actually one of the examples that has already been given, again, by the right wing, of something that they would like to do if the Supreme Court wasn't in their way. And that is that both mass deportations that they're talking about, but also in cases where they cannot deport refugees from Eritrea and places like that where deportation is not an option, both deportation to third countries is something they're discussing, but also what they had in place and the Supreme Court overruled was that they had imprisonment. I mean, they had internment camps for refugees that with no limit to how many years you could spend there. And that's definitely something that it's clear that the government will push for the moment that the Supreme Court becomes irrelevant. And they've said it very clearly. So it's not really an answer to kind of the role of the refugee community within this protest movement, because we see that this protest movement isn't going in that direction. And it's not going in the direction of anything that might seem like it's a bit controversial. I mean, the outskirts of it are like the occupation, like other issues, like people are trying to bring these issues in, but the mainstream of it is not, is really not bringing in those other issues. And there's a lot of kind of similar political issues that are just absent, I'm afraid.
Any additional questions? Yeah, okay. I'm coming. There's a question from our relay. helper on the stage. So I'm delivering the microphone for the people in the audience to hear.
Thank you. My question is about settlers. This sounds like a very, in a very simplistic language, very evil people, horrible. For me, what is interesting from one side, how big is settlers' population in comparison to the rest of Israeli society? So how much percentage are settlers, right? As we can see, they have quite a huge influence on the politics in the country. But also, as you were saying, and also from the news that are coming constantly about settlers, the group, the social group of settlers is very violent, and they are very conservative. So for me, what is interesting, how much of that violence is now spills not only to the Palestinian communities, but also to the protests. So do settlers actually attack protesters or help like a self-organized militia to push the reforms? Yeah.
So just for numbers, settlers are today, I think there's about, a little over half a million settlers, including both East Jerusalem and the rest of the West Bank. That out of a population of around just under 9 million, if I'm not mistaken. So we can do the math about what that means in percentage. But I think it's important to say there are very different kinds of settlers. And if we look at the kind of bigger settlements, like Ariel or the ones around Jerusalem or ones like that, I know these names mean nothing to you, but the kind of bigger settlements that are cities of, 30,000, 40,000 people, a lot of the people who live there, they're ideological reasons. They're definitely not going to go on a hilltop and beat up Palestinians. They don't care. They're there for economic reason. One of the advantages of stolen land is that it's cheaper to build on it. And there's a lot of state subsidies around there. And so that's also a big part of settler population. And I think when we talk about the settler movement, it's the ideological aspect of it. It's not who are actually settlers. It's this religious nationalist right movement that have this supremacy very much in them. And it's important for me to say they don't only operate in the West Bank. In the last decade, they've also really increased their operations within cities in Israel with mixed population, with both Arab and Jewish populations, cities like Jaffa and Lod and Akka, Acres. They're like really, they're settling also there. And I say settling as opposed to, any other Jewish Israeli who lives in these cities, because they're mixed cities. They are settling in the sense that they are moving there with the intention of Judaizing territory. And they say that very clearly. So it's an ideological movement more than an action in a way, or more than where do you live. So that's just important for me to kind of to say generally about settlers and what is their current role. Now, as far as their violence spilling in to Israel, we haven't had too many attacks actually by them on protests. What we have seen is that after every protest in support of the judicial overhaul, and there have been quite a few of them, there are attacks of kind of people around, but they're not of people who are suspected of being center or left. They are Palestinians, of Arabs, right? Like after the big protests, they go and attack Arabs. And it still is very clear that their main kind of target is that, much more than internal Israeli politics, even if a lot of their, hate and anger or political disagreement will be with the Israeli center or left, their actual manifestation of power and of violence is usually very much targeted still towards Palestinians. I think we are seeing a slow shift on that, especially when it comes to LGBTQ. It's still not been in like very severe violence, but traditionally this is the main community, or one of the main communities that has continued to protest against the LGBT community and pride parades and things like that. And that's very much likely to grow. We're seeing quite a strong crackdown from this community and their leaders around trans rights, especially trans children rights, and trying to, I mean, that they're suing doctors currently for supporting transition of minors. And so, I mean, there's a lot of other forms of violence, but the kind of outright attacks from this settler movement are very much targeted towards Palestinians. If there are, you know, Israeli Jewish activists there supporting Palestinians or trying to prevent the violence or whatever, then they'll get some of it as well. But the target, for now at least, remains that. And I think it does have a lot to do with kind of a sense of, or a ideology of supremacy. And that makes the main target Palestinians.
Any other questions? I don't see any raised hands in the audience right now. Yep, then let's wrap it up. Thank you for our speaker.